Transmission start. Welcome to Where Did the Road Go? Join us as we wander off the path and explore lost history, consciousness, the paranormal, unexplained mysteries, alternative thought, and much more. We are present on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com. Now here is your host, Soraya.
All right, welcome to this edition of Where Did the Road Go? Tonight's show is going to be a little bit different than normal. In talking to people over the last week or so, I realized that when we put stuff up on video, a lot of people don't actually watch the videos. You would think YouTube would get more hits on the stuff that was video-oriented than just audio, but that is simply not the case, and I find that fascinating. So there's been a few things I've put up over the last, in the last year that were video-only. Some of them got a decent number of hits, but most of them got far less hits than I would have expected being video. And so I figured, you know, the people who only listen to this as a podcast probably have never heard this stuff. And this first segment we're going to hear, I actually did for Patreons only initially. The video is for Patreons only. And most of the Patreons said, we'd rather just have audio. So you know what? Here's the audio from this. This is from a few weeks back at Albertwitch Day. It was Albertwitch Day. I don't know why I keep wanting to call it Albertwitch Fest, but it was Albertwitch Day. And it features Tim and James of Strange Familiars. It features Adam of Conspiranormal and myself as we kind of talk music for a moment, and then we talk about strange experiences we've all had. And so here you go. This is this conversation, and then I have a few other things for you.
So I'm at the Timothy Renner. Where are we?
We are in the Columbia Historical Preservation Society. This is an old church, and it's supposed to be haunted.
Supposed to be haunted. What has supposedly happened here?
People have seen lights. I believe there's a specific woman. If Chris was here, he could probably tell you her name. There's a specific woman that people see, both here and in the attached house, which is, I guess it was the rectory or something.
You should talk up a little.
Well, I'm not sure it was the rectory. It's where the officiant lived, I believe, whatever denomination this church was.
All right. And we're here with your co-host.
Yep. James.
And are you from here?
Around here. I live in Bainbridge, which is just a few towns over, closer towards, it's past Marietta, but not quite Elizabethtown.
So north of here by 5 miles.
That's seven.
So Tim, are you from here, Columbia?
I am from across the river.
Across the great Susquehanna?
Yeah, so you know, there's a serious competition between people who live in Lancaster and those who live in York.
Oh.
And ne'er the two shall meet. So this is like us coming together in this podcast. It's about
peace
in the Middle East. It really is. The fact that we're doing this podcast together, I say it's about comparable to that.
Jeez.
Not really.
We also have Adam Sane.
That's right.
Conspiranormal.
Recording for
what? What are you recording for?
I'm recording for Conspiranormal.
Really? Yeah, that's a good idea.
Sort of.
So this.
We don't have, and we're without recorders. We feel like.
So this was Albertwitch Day.
Albertwitch Day.
Oh, come on, just say Albertwitch.
Albertwitch Day.
My Brian, who you were talking to, my bandmate in Albertwitch, calls it Albertwitch, and he's in the band. So
there we go.
However you want to pronounce it.
You know, it was good to see Stone Breath for sure. You did a good job for saying you hadn't played in a year, and you
it was
had
quite
a
good
practice. But you know, Albertwitch would have been more appropriate. Although you did say that would probably destroy everybody's eardrums.
The very first year, they asked for Albertwitch. Because we were on Albertwitch.com, Albertwitch.org, and I guess when they started to do the festival, they said, well, let's get Albertwitch, the band, to play.
Well, yeah, that's just common sense.
And I said, you really don't want...
And then they went and listened to it?
They listened to it, and they still wanted us to play. Which I was like, do you really? Like, it's a family day, and you really want us to play?
For no one that knows, describe the musical style of
Albertwitch. Well, it's extremely political, and it's very anarchist based, so it's very kind of anarcho noise folk, grindcore, black metal all thrown together in a crazy...
And what's the name of the album?
We have two albums. The first one is called Only Dead Birds Weep Over the Graves of Fallen King. And the second album is... So if corporations are people, why don't they die?
Yeah, that's great.
Nice, right?
I used one of those songs on the end of Where'd the Road Go, and he heard it, and he was like, more Albatwitch!
Albatwitch, we get requests to play live all the time, and Brian
Tim
won't
do it.
Will do it, Brian will do it.
How many bands do you have, Tim?
Today?
Yes, today.
Well, Albatwitch is on an extended break.
So okay.
There's Stone Breath, and then there's another thing coming.
Okay. How many bands have you had in your life?
Too many. Too many.
How many bands do you have?
Oh, jeez. I started doing this stuff when I was 15, so... like four or five.
Are you
five,
in, are you in any currently?
Yeah.
Okay, I didn't know.
I'm working on a project called Orphan.
What is it?
It's called Orphan.
Orphan?
Yeah.
What style of music?
Jeez, that's one of those. It's heavy.
Polka.
It's polka. It's,
oh, heavy polka. That's
speed,
great.
Speed polka. It's all heavy instrumentation and progressive, but also heavy in just sort of the vibe because it is all very personal stuff that I am putting into Orphan, so...
Nice. All right, so let's go around here. What's the weirdest thing that's happened to you in your life?
The weirdest thing that's happened? Is it okay to recycle something that I've talked about before? Because it still kind of holds up as like the pinnacle of weird.
Sure.
So as a kid, about 12 years old, I had an older brother who was involved in the punk rock nightclub sort of life that was happening in York back during the late 80s, early 90s. And when my parents got split up, when my parents split, my brother would let me come out to hang out with him at this place. So I was like a 12-year-old hanging out with a bunch of adults, checking out all kinds of industrial and punk rock bands. And it was really nice to have a place to go that wasn't with my mom or with my dad. It was kind of a neutral place where I was getting to meet people. And my brother and his friends were into a lot of bizarre stuff. They messed around, I believe, with like witchcraft and stuff. There was one such night that I was there, and it was a night like any other night. And I would always hang out on the balcony because even at 12 years old, I liked to watch the girls on the dance floor. You know what I mean? It was a good place to be where you're kind of out of sight, but still able to see everything, observe. And while I am up there watching people and listening to music, I experienced something visually that was very strange to me. It was it was almost like there was a form on the dance floor with the other people, and no one else was noticing it was there. It was a very massive form, and as a kid, it occurred to me that it looked like a like an oversized gorilla sitting cross-legged on the ground, and everyone was just sort of moving around it, and I could see it, moving, and the way the light sort of moved off of it. It didn't scare me initially, but I pointed it out to my brother, and him and his friends at that time kind of freaked. They freaked out pretty hard.
So they saw it too.
Right. Well, I don't know if they saw it. I was explaining to them what I was looking
at. Oh, I see. Okay.
And they wanted my brother's goal at that point was to get me out. And he and those people all sort of talked and kind of were huddling, and I'm like, what's going on, you know? And I think that in retrospect, it's probably one of those, like, it's better, you know, to know less about what you might be seeing. And the idea was for me to walk home because the club was literally like a few blocks away from where my mother lived in the city. So they walked me out, and they're like, really sorry, you know, next week, you know, promise. And I was kind of bummed out to have to roll, and I start walking up the street, and I get, you know, maybe a block up. And as I'm walking, all the lights behind me start shutting off on the street.
So you've become a slider.
Yeah, it was crazy. This is on Beaver Street in New York City, like right near the square. the hair sticking up on the back of my neck. Like, literally, as I'm walking, the streetlights are going up. Mm-hmm. I mean, I caught the reflection of it in the building across the street. And at that point, like, my brother and his friends are, come back, come back, come back. And I went back, and somebody decided to just give me a ride a couple blocks away to my house. And that was pretty weird. I still don't know exactly what to make of that experience. But it was one of many experiences that happened in that place. But the biggest, most profound, and sort of in my face thing that had happened for sure.
Do you find that you affect electronics?
Since I was a kid, yeah.
Yeah. Do you know the history of that place? Do you know anything about it?
I hear things, and you know, this is sort of unsubstantiated, but like, you know, there's a lot of stories about that particular square of York City, what it was in times past, and what it became. I know that the building in particular where this incident had happened, before it was a nightclub, it was a ballroom in the early 20th century going in. Eventually it was abandoned. I believe it was a radio station at some point. It had gone through a lot of sort of, like, turn of the century, it was a ballroom. And then eventually it became like more of like a, you know, like a ballroom dancing kind of fun, hip thing. And I think that eventually it became like a radio station. And then after that it sat for a while until the proprietors at that time purchased it and decided to turn it into a nightclub. It seems like everything that was there at some point had some sort of major issues that just failed. Bad things would sort of happen there. You know, this is the early 90s, so there was a lot of violence within like those scenes of folks. There were skinheads. There was a lot of racial violence during that time. So there was a lot of sort of negativity that would kind of get cooped up in that place. You know, at this point in my life, I'm sort of more interested in the places that these events happen in, because it seems like there's like this reoccurring thing that happens in places such as, you know, Gettysburg, things like that.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Maybe not so much the things that happen there as much as something about that place, you know, like what's in the ground, what's reflecting and what's amplifying, you know, the different sort of energies and things in places. But that whole skinned Invisa Gorilla situation is probably by far one of the weirdest things I've actually seen.
Yeah,
that is strange.
Yeah. Anything weird happened to you lately, Tim?
Lately?
Aliens following around.
I don't think anything that I haven't talked about you with.
Okay.
Did I ever tell you the story of my Allison and I before we were married in the missing time? Did I tell you that?
I don't know.
Okay, so
I haven't heard it, so this will be good.
So there was when Allison and I first started dating, we went to a place. It's called Soldier's Delight. It's in Maryland. It's a park, and we went there, and it was daylight. I believe it was early afternoon, and we were to meet someone at 9 o'clock that night. So we went off into the woods, and we found this beautiful clearing. It was a perfect circle. It's no trees and just beautiful grass, and we sat down and did what young men and women do when they're alone. And while we were there, a doe came up and walked around us.
Uh-huh, okay.
Three times. And I tried to shoo it away.
Three times.
It wouldn't go away.
It's in that three again.
Which is kind of unusual for a deer, because they usually just run.
No mama deer. Yeah. Just little doe. And it stared at us, and then it made its way off eventually. And as we were walking out of the woods, it was getting dark. So
did you tell the part where you shooshed it away and you're trying to get rid of it?
Yeah, I tried to shoo it away. It did not. It did not go until it was done. It's three circles around its creatures. And we left. And it was dark as we're walking out of the woods, so it didn't even occur to me at the time that there's possible missing time there.
Wow.
But now that I think back, it's like, we went into the woods in the afternoon and we didn't come back out until it was dark. By the time we met the person we were supposed to meet at 9 p.m., it was after 10 p.m., so, and they were maybe 15 minutes from the park.
I have a deer story I've never told. So I was doing a ritual in the middle of a field, like way out in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of a field, and I drew this circle, and I was making noise, middle of the night, pitch black. But there's nothing for miles around, so I'm making all this noise. I get done, I break the circle, something hisses at me from right in front of me. And I immediately jump and grab the light I had sitting outside the circle and turn it, and there's a deer standing there staring at me. Yeah. And then it just kind of like looks at me for a few minutes and runs away. And I'm like, why would a deer come up to me, even in the dark? It's, you know, I was making all this noise and doing all this stuff, and it just walked right up to the edge of the circle. Never came inside the circle.
You know, Mike Clellan said he doesn't want to do it because he doesn't want to write another book that involved, but he said he could write a whole other one on deer.
Yeah, I'm like sure.
So somebody else needs to do that. Maybe you, Tom.
Maybe.
Maybe that's the next project.
Have I ever asked you if you've had any weird experiences?
Nothing lately, man.
Are you guys pointing your devices at each other?
Yeah. I haven't had anything lately. All my stuff always happened when I was a kid.
Okay.
I think I've told you the main one.
Which was?
The old lady in the room.
I don't know.
I woke up in the middle of the night. I was probably about 7 years old. And there was an old lady in the corner. And I kind of remember it as being like a dream. I walk into the, it's like I almost like walk into the bathroom and there's like this old guy in a bathtub. That's what I remember. And then like I remember like part of the dream was seeing like my grandparents' house burning down. Well, about 7 years later, I'm 14, I'm in Virginia Beach. My aunt is and my mother are talking because my mother had had some experiences in that house, same house, and my aunt had lived in the house. My dad was renting it from my grandfather, so he grew up in that house as well. And she said she woke up in the middle of the night and there was an old lady in the corner. So it was like a validation of what happened to me as well. And it's weird because you mentioned Mike Clellan. When he said he had that dream of, he had that encounter with three figures standing outside, there was, it almost had a dreamlike quality to it. It was like he fell back to sleep. And that's something again and again that I hear is people seeing something and then just immediately just falling back to sleep.
It could be an altered state too.
Right.
In my maybe abduction thing, I was in and out of sleep. And mad and angry and trying to scream at the things, trying to hit the things, but to keep falling asleep.
It's very similar to what I experienced, except mine was more like when I was a kid, mine was more like a ghost thing.
But there's that three thing again, you know. Most people, seems like this reoccurring thing, like when people start talking about these things, they talk about sleep paralysis and they talk about these things that they saw, whether it was like, you know, whether they were awake or not, you know, there's like this, you know, there's like this sort of three voices, three shapes, three, you know, people, three completely, you know, innocuous, you know, nothing that would raise a, you know, crazy alarm, but it was always that sort of three.
Well, the three knocks phenomenon, you know.
Sure.
Which, as I've heard people point out, that, you know, normally that's what we do anyway, is we like knock three times. So it's like a habit.
It's interesting to me to hear the story that, you know, you had an experience and your mother also had an experience, because I just was talking to a friend about some things that had happened with him when he was a kid that I totally had no idea about, because he's one of those people that's like, I've had these things happen and they happen, but like I don't subscribe to any of this stuff. Right, so it's like interesting when these things sort of present themselves to people who are completely close to it. And he still is sort of that attitude, but talking to him, I could tell that he's also interested at the same time. And he was talking about a situation where he had an experience and he had kept it to himself. He had saw something, someone in the house, and there were some very specific things about that someone that he saw briefly. And his mother was talking about thinking she saw someone, this is like 3 days later, she had seen someone and was describing them to him, and he's thinking about what he had seen. And then there's that one main thing that he took from his sighting that she mentioned that he never, you know, he never even mentioned it to her.
Right.
And it's just one of those wild things where it's like, you know, we have a son and a mother who both saw this.
Yeah, in my case, my aunt saw it 30 years before I did.
Wow.
And there was, you know, some rumor, I guess, before my grandfather bought the house.
Were you aware of this rumor when it was?
No, not when I was 7.
Yeah.
There was, supposedly, when my grandfather bought the house, and this would have been early 50s, there was an older couple that had lived in the house for a very long time. So we just assumed that that's probably who they were. The house is no longer there. After my grandfather sold it, it got, whatever company bought it, knocked it down, put condos in its place.
Definitely demons.
Definitely demons.
It's always demons.
It's got to be demons, man.
And any progress on your jigsaw in the wilderness, the woods there?
The jigsaw? Oh, my chessboard.
Chessboard, yeah. That's
chessboard has been inactive.
Oh.
In fact, I still check it, but I've all but abandoned the chessboard for a new thing in the same area, probably about a half mile away in the same park. There's what I'm calling the offering tree. So we'll see what happens with that.
All right, cool, cool.
All right, and as I said, if you're a Patreon, you can actually watch the video of that. There's a link up in the Patreon section. This next clip I did back in, I think, January. This is my co-host from The Last Exit for the Lost, Joe. And he had a weird experience he told me about years ago, and I just never talked to him about it for the show and just put up the video clip for it. It's definitely a weird thing. So it's kind of a void in the woods. So here you go. This is a short little segment of him telling the story. So I'm here with Joe, my co-host on The Last Exit for the Lost. And years ago, you told me about a weird story of something that happened to you down in Pennsylvania. And for some reason, we never recorded this for Where Did the Road Go? But I think it's, if you remember it clearly, it was a pretty interesting story.
I can remember enough of it to get through it. So it was going to college down in Pennsylvania. College is out in the middle of nowhere, really. Woods all over the place. And all of the student parking was up through the woods, around corners, and there was just random plateaus of parking lots. And like off of the road leading through all the parking lots was like, you know, ATV trails. They just went off into the woods. And you know, a bunch of us like, oh, man, we gotta check these out sometime and actually, you know, see if they go anywhere or whatever. And eventually we decide to do it, and it just happens to be, you know, at night, because why wouldn't it be?
Right, of course.
You know, you can't do things in the daytime. It was dusk-ish, and it's probably 7-10 of us, and we just start walking. And we get in a ways, and getting twilight, and you know, there's still enough light coming through where you can, you know, you can see and you can make things out, and you know, it's shadowy but not pitch black. And we get a ways in, and you get some people, you know, starting to get a little uneasy and, you know, like borderline freaking out a little bit. So, you know, we gotta go back, you know, I don't want to be out here anymore, just something's just not right. And you know, it's group mentality, and it starts to, you know, build and build, and more people start freaking out.
Sure.
And we keep going, and we notice this something weird up ahead of us. And you know, at first we're just like, oh, you know, it's getting darker, it's getting darker, so you know, so it's going to be, you know, heavier shadowing in the woods and whatnot. And as we keep progressing, we notice that it's just a nothing. It's like a void. You know, and just like, oh, it's probably just shadowing on trees and stuff. And it's just, as we try to figure it out more, we notice that it's bigger than it should be if it was a shadow from trees and branches.
And this was in the trail ahead of you?
This was in the trail ahead of us. You know, and what is this? It's just like, you know, it's like just complete blackness. And it's you know, it's a pretty good area it's covering. It was like, you know, we realize that this just can't be, you know, shadows coming through the trees, and you know, it's night, so it's dark. It's like this, you know, it was night over here, and it was night over there, and then up there is just something completely different. Yeah. So then we start going back and forth. It's like, well, we gotta figure out what it is. No, we should run away. No, we've gotta figure out what it is. No, we should run away. And the people that wanted to run away win. So instead of, you know, walking into this random void that we have no idea what it is, we decide that maybe we should go this way instead. And, you know, it's we end up walking through, you know, who knows how long we were in there. And, you know, we come out and it was just a clearing in a house.
Did you ever go back there?
We kind of, in a roundabout way, going back to campus, kind of tromped back through the general area. Nothing else, like, we didn't notice anything else on the way back. I couldn't get anyone else to go back that way or try to figure out where, you know, where exactly we were, you know, later in the semester or whatever, and I wasn't going to go by myself. So it just kind of ended up being, you know, this great mystery. It's, you know, what was it? You know, nobody knows, but nobody wants to find out, and we just kind of let it go.
Fair enough. All right, thanks.
All right, and now another short segment, which I also recorded during the last Exit for the Lost. This is a friend of mine, Dustin, who was in a band called Rip Open the Sky. And he had, the first time I met him, he started telling me about this weird dream experience he had. And I've never heard quite anything like it. So I had him talk about it. And here it is.
So would you like to introduce yourself?
My name is Dustin. I'm 27, live in Corning. That's about all you need to know.
And you're in a band.
I'm in a band, Rip Open the Sky.
Now, you were telling me a few months ago now that you had some very weird dream experiences.
Yeah. So I started to study astral projection and, you know, just breathing techniques and realizing when you're falling asleep. And one night, after about 6-7 months of really trying, I was able to successfully do it. And I found myself at a beach, which I later discovered was probably Oregon, Washington area. Just I Googled it and they look similar.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so I was definitely there. You know, I could feel the sand and the water and just the breeze of the ocean. And there's a group of kids there right around my age. And they said, oh, hey, man, welcome to the Dream Club. And I was like, Dream Club, what is this? They're like, oh, well, you know, we all practice what you're doing. And, you know, we get together when we can and just have fun. I was like, okay, cool. So they showed me around and we were having fun. And then I just kind of heard this, like, buzzer, like, I was like, what is that? And they said, oh, well, it's time for you to go back. I said, oh, okay. Went back and, you know, woke up, remembered everything. I was like, oh, this is awesome. I got to try it again. Took me about another couple weeks before I successfully did it again. And this time, it was the same exact group of people, guys and girls, except this time we were in a really seedy-looking warehouse, and they just weren't as nice this time. And they were asking me to do things like cut my hand open and bleed on the floor. And I said, no, you know, of course not. And they're like, oh, just, you know, we're all doing it, man. It was, you know, no. I was like, I want to leave. And they said, no, you can't leave yet. It's not your time. I said, no, I'm out of here. And they started to get really angry and try to keep me there. And I was able to start, when I started to leave, I saw this face, this really, really demonic looking face just screaming at me. And that's the last image I remember. And I woke up just terrified, never did it again. And I Googled for months and months and months trying to find what this face was, like if it was an entity or what was it. The closest thing I found was, I finally learned who Aleister Crowley was.
Crowley,
my bad.
No, it's okay.
Mr. Crowley. That's probably why I say it.
Yeah, that's why everyone says it.
Yeah.
But he always said Crowley and rhymes with holy.
Yeah. Unholy Crowley. He drew a depiction of the entity that he summoned. I forgot.
Is this Lamb?
I think so.
The sort of gray-headed
looked
thing?
Like a gray, yeah.
That's Lamb.
Yeah, and that was the closest image I could find of the face that was screaming at me. And ever since then, I just haven't even given it a go. And
did it feel different than a normal dream?
Yes. Okay. It was real. It was like I was awake as I am right now.
Hmm.
It was absolutely terrifying.
I can understand that.
Yeah.
All right. Cool. Thanks.
Yeah, no problem. Hope it was insightful. And if anybody else encounters Dream Club. Also, I should mention, I did tell this dream to another guy. People call him crazy. I just call him logical. But I told him the words Dream Club specifically. He said, dude, never go back. Stay away. It's evil. So if anybody else experiences it, I want to know.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
All right, cool. Thanks, Dustin.
Yeah, no problem.
All right. Now, this brings us up to the Travis Walton interview. This is Travis Walton and Jennifer Stein. And this was at the premiere of the Travis documentary that they had in Ithaca. And the documentary is excellent. And I got to talk to Travis and Jennifer outside. So it's a little noisy. As you'll notice, all of these, because they were just in random places with a video camera, have different sound quality. But in this one, you can't really hear me that well, but you can hear them just fine. So you can hear my questions. It's just not as loud as it should be. So this is my conversation with Travis Walton and Jennifer Stein from back in May.
Hi, I'm Travis Walton, here for the showing here in the State Theater of the Travis documentary that Jennifer here
produced. And I'm Jennifer Stein. I produced the film Travis, The True Story of Travis Walton, and we're really thrilled to be screening it here in Ithaca in the latter part of May. It's one of our first premier theater screenings, and it's going really well.
How long did this take to put together?
All total, just almost 5 years. It was a good 3 hardcore working and another 2 on either end doing, you know, pre-planning and then post-work. So totally about five years.
It's a very well put together documentary, so the time was definitely worth it. You had one other movie made about you, a fictional one.
Yeah, Paramount did a dramatic presentation, and that was starred James Garner, Robert Patrick, D.B. Sweeney.
Were you happy with that one?
Well, I think it did achieve increasing people's interest to look further, you know, to perhaps, you know, get to the facts. Because most people realize that any kind of a theatrical movie or dramatic presentation is not, it's not a documentary. So they very often follow up, they want the book too.
The, this kind of picks, it doesn't cover the actual event that everyone pretty much knows about. This is kind of the other stuff that was going on at the time.
Well, it does go into it.
Yes, it does.
It, and there's it a, does, there's but a, I mean, it doesn't just, it's not just about that.
It's event. Not just Correct. That, but it does include a very nice reenactment with some good graphic art representations.
Because I feel like it's not just for someone who doesn't know about it. It's for people who already know about it but want more details.
Yes,
more
there's a lot of background and a lot of subsequent research that, you know, helped to confirm or rebut certain theories that were offered to try to explain it.
I was pretty amazed at the that one of your friends tried to buy him off.
Yes, that was definitely a bribe, and there's absolutely no doubt that the this actually occurred. The message was delivered by one of the local sheriff's deputies.
Wow. That's one of the main things that I feel proud of that the film really attempted to tackle as a documentary. Because a lot of UFO films don't really deal with the debunking issue. Yeah. And this film really tries to unpack that a little bit. And it talks about the terrible effect that that can have on people's lives and really how the whole debunking effort, which was massive on their case, because there was so much reliable evidence that really wanted to be squelched by people who didn't want this story out.
I've always even taken exception to the term debunking, because they're not removing bunk so much as creating bunk.
True.
It's really just a smear campaign, you know, a targeted media campaign to try to refute something that in many cases may or may not be deserving of such treatment.
Yeah.
And in many cases, all they really need to do is create doubt in people's minds. And they can do that by creating doubt around the facts or creating doubt around the character of the people.
If you're already eager to find a reason to disbelieve it, some of the thinnest things that were used to explain away are really kind of silly when they're given a little further examination. Things about drug hallucinations or mass hysteria or... you know, the psychological things that would not affect an entire group of people. People don't experience identical hallucinations.
Right. And I always find it interesting that some of the explanations are far more out there than the initial claims themselves. Yeah, they're like, wait a minute. And they don't feel like they have to back those up.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, well, we explained it, there we go. It's like, but no, you didn't.
It's a favorite tactic of skeptics to act as if the unproven is the absolute equivalent of disproven.
Yes.
And that's not the case at all.
If you had the ability to go back and erase this event from your life, would you?
I think I would, yeah. I'd rather it never happened. You know, you're stuck with it. You have to go forward, you know. Yeah. What happened, happened. And,
it would make your life a very different life today.
Sure.
That's one of the main things we really attempted to capture in the film, is the effect that it had on all of these men, especially Travis, but the other members of the crew as well. It hasn't been easy for them. And they were very willing to be honest about that. And I was very grateful as a filmmaker to be able to capture that. And it's not just the film or the crew that we interviewed. We went and interviewed police and people who worked in the community at the time, the person who was involved in the lie detection at the time, Cy Gilson. So we really got their feedback and experience as well with a 40-year perspective.
And it seems like this was a good point to do that, because a lot of these people probably aren't going to be alive much longer. I mean, some of them were older when this happened. You were 23?
I was 22 at the time,
22,
yeah.
And so some of them were probably, in their 30s and 40s, like a police officer and...
Yeah.
Yes, we've already lost Marlon Gillespie.
Yeah, the sheriff, and one of his deputies has since passed away. I think maybe two of his deputies. Yeah.
So it's really valuable that you got as many people as you did on film talking about this stuff.
And we also put in some archive footage as well. And there's a lot of UFO experts in the film talking about their research of the case at the time, their research on it following up over the years, and how they feel about it now. So we've really tried to create a distance perspective on this issue, to say that it was important then, it's still important now, and it's probably still going to be important in the future.
Well, I feel like it's one of those cases that's undeniable. You know, you had something extraordinary happen to you. There's no way to argue it. There's no good evidence that didn't happen. So many UFO cases, there's that sketchiness sometimes around the corners where you can say, well...
Especially when they employ the propaganda techniques, it's the anything that you can create doubt with. They haven't disproven anything, they've just, created doubt, and that's enough for some people.
And I think even some of the more hardened skeptics will admit something happened to you. You know, you've always come across as being very genuine about the experience.
They just believe this happened, but what actually happened?
Right.
They can, like you say, some of the attempts to explain it away are even more far out than extraterrestrials. some sort of seismic shift in the ground could create massive voltages that would alter people's perceptions. You know, and seven people identically again.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. People don't, as you say, people don't generally hallucinate the same thing. And when they do, it might not be a hallucination. It might be an altered state, but obviously they're interacting with something that's directing that altered state, if that's the case. Did you have any other experiences in your life?
I did experience one a few years back with a large group of other observers. It was one of those giant black triangles, but I kind of lean in favoring that is some sort of covert military development. But it was definitely nothing conventional.
Have you had any other non-UFO weird experiences, anything paranormal?
Yeah, there's a lot of some strange things that happen in connection with something like this, but I've always tried to stick strictly to the things that I can document. Because the whole reason to get out here with a case this strong is to point to the evidence. And if you have something that sounds rather fantastic and you have nothing more than I say it happened, that weighs in the other direction and it's counterproductive.
It gives the skeptic some ammunition there.
Yeah.
Do you affect electronics?
Pardon?
Do you affect like wristwatches or anything like that?
Yeah, I've had that kind of thing in my life. Yeah.
Always, or only after
these? Probably all my life, static electricity type stuff,
Because a lot of people who have UFO experiences find themselves unable to wear wristwatches, they affect computers, and so on and so forth. It's one of the it's also a common after effect of near-death experiences, interestingly enough.
Wow, I didn't realize that.
Yeah. Kenneth Ring did a whole study on UFO experiences and near-death experiences and found a lot of commonalities, and one of them was the electrosensitivity, that they both affect electronics more often than not.
Wow, that's really interesting.
So where is the documentary going to be available?
Well, it's available at the main website, TravisWaltonTheMovie.com. It's also available on Travis's website.
Which is TravisWalton.com.
Which is TravisWalton.com. So those two places are really the only place people can buy the film, unless it's available for sale at a conference. Or
yeah, wherever her or I might be speaking personally.
And sometimes where we are doing screenings, we usually bring some copies of the film.
Which they can get autographed.
Yes, there's actually a couple versions of the film. When we started the film, we realized within the first year and a half that we were going to have to reshoot some of the film because I licensed some archive footage. And as you can understand, sometimes licensing deals don't always materialize the way you anticipate. And my licensing deal fell through after I paid for it. Oh. So I needed to either sue or go back and renegotiate or buy new licensing from someone else. And I took the third option because it was the simplest to do because I had a film to make. And so there's a couple versions. The newer version we're attempting to sell to a network. It's about 20 to 30% new material in it. We also did some more in-depth tree investigation research in the process. And, you know, did some new updated interviews, took out one of the American Polygraph people from the 1970s and put in someone who gave an American Polygraph perspective for 40 years. So we changed out a few things, added in a few other experts. So that version we're hoping that a distributor will pick up, and hopefully we can get it out to some art house theaters or bundle it with some other interesting UFO documentaries. Maybe it'll go to Netflix, History Channel, Sci-Fi, History 2, Destination America. There's a lot of places where it would really fit. And we're hoping to get their attention and get a distributor interested.
Are you thoroughly sick of talking about this event yet?
Well, some questions get a little tedious occasionally. You know, some questions you're like, why would anybody ask that? You know, like, let's see, what would one? What was that like? I mean, how do you answer a question like that? Come on, let's get a little more specific there.
And he gets asked similar questions again and again and again and again. You know, did the ETs, you know, talk to you in your mind? Do you have nightmares about them? You know, do you have any special powers because of that?
Are you Superman?
Shh.
when that happened to you, what... Like, before you went through the hypnosis and stuff, what is, like, the last thing you remember and the first thing you remember?
Well, the idea with regression, the technique at the time was to begin in a particular point in time and then regress in, you know, backward in time.
But, like, when it happened, what did you remember initially?
The regressive hypnosis was not successful at recovering much in the way of blocked memories. It established that there was a difficulty accessing certain things, but the main thing that was achieved there was to separate this overpowering fear from the ability to just describe what happened.
So it helped you deal with the fear, basically.
Yeah, and it actually had a sort of a lasting effect. An ongoing reduction in the amount of emotion that accompanied talking about it. Because up to that point, I had only tried to talk about it to my brother and the sheriff, and I could hardly finish a sentence. It was.
Do you remember running up to it though?
Like yeah, okay. I did.
Uh-huh. So you remember up to the point that you got shot, basically.
Yeah, and I remember the things on board too, but it was. Just something I couldn't verbalize, you know.
It doesn't seem like it was a fun experience in any way, shape, or form.
No.
What I like to point out to people is that Travis had memory at the moment that he woke up on the side of the street.
Yeah.
As soon as he came to, he recognized, and he looked up and he saw this light above him, and then the light disappears. He knew what that light was. He wasn't confused. He immediately had this fear rushing back. He remembered running up to the craft in the forest. He knew it had been the end of a work day. So there wasn't a lapse in memory. So when he went to do a regression, the purpose of that regression was to see if there was anything that could be recovered, but also to really bring down this post-traumatic stress experience that he was having.
And it was enormous. I mean, that was one of the main points that, you know, the various reporters, you know, described at that time.
Yeah, I'm sure it gave him some nightmares and such as well.
Yeah, it was.
Does
definitely.
It still?
No, that went away gradually, you know. There's occasionally where, you know, I'm making the sounds of fighting in my sleep, but when I wake up, I don't remember in particular those kind of scenes anymore.
All right. Well, I think both of you should spend some time talking to me about this. The documentary is excellent.
Well, thank you very much. That's a lovely
compliment.
I saw
one of the early ones because Peter had given me a copy, and I was very, very impressed. And I'm glad you did this. And I'm glad you're willing to talk about it, because I think that's, you know, it's such an important thing to get out there.
There are times I get tempted to say, oh, walking away from this, I'm never going to talk about this
sure.
again.
Sure. But the fact that you are such a, you're someone who resonates sort of with believability. You're not making any outrageous claims. You're not, you know, you have the evidence to back it up. Like I said, it's one of those cases where it's hard to deny that something happened to you.
Yeah, well, there it is. There's the evidence. Take it or leave it.
I'll tell you one of the things that really impressed me about Travis. I mean, I bought his book and read it, and I think one of the motivating factors for me to want to get to know Travis better is he never decided to come forward. Many people have an opportunity or a chance to make that decision. They'll have an experience. They'll be with a couple of people maybe even. But by the time Travis was returned, he had been missing. And because he was missing, this story became a homicide story, a missing person story, a potential, you know, hoax, you know, a UFO story.
But world news.
And world news.
Yeah.
So
before I talked to anybody.
When he came back, he had the police and the press literally hounding at his door. I mean, they were hounding his family prior to his being returned. So that made it.
And here I was avoiding interviews, and they were saying, aha, that's suspicious, he's avoiding interviews. As soon as I started doing interviews, then I'll say, oh, he's a publicity seeker, huh?
Of course.
So damned if you do and damned if you don't.
There's
you know?
No winning to those people at all.
Yeah. And I think that's why you really need a documentary to kind of really unpack the pieces of this and let people understand that this is not a simple story. This is not something you want to have happen to you.
No.
But when it does, we really need to be, you know, as a progressive society, there should be support for people who have experienced something
yes.
like this, and there's
yes.
not. So their lives get ripped apart. Their loved ones, you know, abandon them. The time in their life when they really need the most support, it's very hard to find. And I think the more we begin to accept this and understand this, possibly through getting to know Travis, reading his book, seeing his documentary, if that can help a few other people, then he's done his job and I've done mine.
All right. And I have one other clip from that night that I'm going to play you now. This is Audrey, and she is the person that People of Earth was actually based on. They came and they, I think it's Starborn, was the name of her group, and they came and kind of observed and then used that as fodder for the show. And I do like the show. Now, anyone who has been listening to this show for any length of time knows I have some issues with hypnosis, and she's had a lot of hypnosis. I don't doubt her experiences whatsoever, but I wonder how much hypnosis has played a part in making them something different than what they may have originally been. But there's no way we'll ever know that. So I'm just going to let her tell her story. She was a wonderful person. And if you watch the video of this, all these videos are up on our YouTube. She's practically crying when she's telling some of this stuff. It's so emotionally charged for her. So this is the last segment for tonight. This is Audrey talking about her experiences again at the Travis premiere back in May.
Hi, I'm Audrey Starborn. I'm a lifelong experiencer. I'm an identical twin who's also an abductee. We like to say experiencers because not all experiencers are abductees, but all abductees are contactees. So, a lot of communication happens without removing the actual person through astral, through dreams, through different visions and so forth. They have quite a few ways of communicating when they want to. I believe that the ones that are taking physically, that they actually need to use some kind of genetic sampling that they need to actually physically get from us. Hybrid program, big one. I've been, I don't want to say victim of, but I've been a participant, not willingly, or at least not knowing willingly, of that hybrid program for a very long time. It was years before I even understood that what I was going through may be aliens. Back in the 70s, I was born in 73. My first 10 years in Ohio, that's where the contact began. Now, we were so small, and I'm talking in the crib still, when they'd come to get us, that my sister and I just assumed that that's just part of the natural sleep cycle and everybody gets it. Wasn't until people started telling me that it didn't exist, it was just a dream, when I knew that was wrong, because dreams you can't smell, I smell them, dreams you can't feel, I feel them, see them, it's a physical thing. So that does more harm than good. 2004, I had reached a really bad point in my life and decided I needed to just run away. I went to Florida and stayed with my aunt and uncle, who I barely knew at the time. And this was my first time in Florida. My whole life I've had a healthy respect, I don't like to say fear, healthy respect for the ocean and its contacts. I never liked to go in it, I've always had fear. So, you know, to me, more of outer space has been explored than our own oceans. So we don't belong there. We're not built for it. God knows us back there waiting when you're swimming. You know, I just have this really weird, almost unnatural phobia, even when I was a child, of going in to the ocean. Any other water's fine, no ocean. Well, I was in Florida. I had just started a new job. I met a man, Kip, and he wanted to do something, so I decided to ask my aunt and uncle and Kip to go to Daytona Beach, right next to Ormond Beach, right on the line. Now, it was a beautiful day. I'm in Florida, never been there before. It was hot. Kip went in the water. My aunt and uncle stayed on the beach, and he coaxed me in. He said, let's get beyond the fear. Just come in, up to your knees. I went in about this far, up to my knees, and right as I stepped in, I was grabbed by a rip current, pulled out to sea instantly. No idea what was going on. I remember fighting it at first. I remember watching Kip because he was in it, but he was able to get out of it because he was at the beginning of it. So he got out, swam as hard as he could, and got help. Now in the meantime, I don't know if you understand what a rip current does, but it literally grabs you and pulls you out. Now, as it's building, you're dropped to the bottom of the ocean and you're standing there and these waves are building up all around you, ready to come down. So as they would come down, I would jump to get momentum to keep my head above the water. I remember looking at the people who are now the size of ants, all the hundreds of people who have gathered and all the emergency lights, and I thought to myself, that's all for me, I'm going to die. Well, I wasn't scared. It was more of a fear that came to me because when I left so suddenly, I left my family with some fractured relationships, said some bad things, felt really bad. So that's all I thought about. In a flash, I was above my body and I'm looking down at myself, watching myself drown, looking at the beach, and I'm seeing, you know, there's three people there that love me and they're watching this, and it was devastating. The next thing I know, I'm snapped back into my body, fighting for air again. And I come up in between cycles of the waves and I hear my name being called three times, Audrey, Audrey, Audrey. It's coming from behind me in the open ocean. I look towards where the voice was coming from and there was this, I'm sorry, I get emotional. This beautiful blonde man with these amazing eyes that I'll never forget. They were almost opaque, but they had an amber glow to them. They were glowing. He said, Audrey, threw me a rope, and he said, "You take this rope because this next wave is going to do us in." Took the rope, and I wrapped it around my wrist. Next thing I know, I'm on the beach being resuscitated by, you know, five lifeguards. I pushed him off me right away, got up, because I was scared that the man that was trying to save me was still out there. I thought maybe it was a surfer, or maybe nobody saw him, and that at the very least, I wanted to say thank you for saving my life. Well, when I pushed them off of me and said, "Where's the blonde that saved me? Where is he? Where is he?" They said, "Oh no, it took five of us swimming all we could to come and get you. We almost had to call the Coast Guard. You almost died." So they put me in an ambulance and they bring me to the hospital, and Kip comes in, the one that got out that was in the rip current with me, and he said, "I saw the blonde that you're talking about. I saw him. You have a guardian angel. He saved you." So I had someone there for me that knew what happened, and he told everybody for the whole rest of his life. That's the first thing he said, was, "I watched this girl get saved by an angel." The next day, I went to work, and there was newspapers spread all over our stations. We were florists. Kip worked with me. Our job had heard what happened, so of course Kip had to call and tell everybody that I was rescued by an angel. So the next day, we had all of the articles on my workstation telling about the rip current that hit that coast at that very same time, and everyone else caught in it died. I'm the only one that got out.
Wow.
So to say that was life-changing, it was really confusing at the time, though, because I wasn't aware, like I said, of any ET species besides the grays, because I'd had hypnosis done to uncover that several years before. Well, right after my experience and my near-death, and I call it my rebirth, because my whole soul, everything I thought before, everything I felt I needed to do was different, and it was changed. And then I started to have visions in contact all the time, and they were pushing me to do something that I didn't want to do. You know, like, "I don't want to deal with this. Why are you choosing me?" Well, once I started getting the premonitions and realizing that they're all coming true, and some other weird stuff happened, I took off and I went to Massachusetts, where I'm from, and drove to Maine, where I'm still at today. Now, on November 5th of 2006, I was visited by one of these beings. It was she was female. She was glowing white. She had the same eyes. She came to me and said, "Audrey, it's time for you to start what you're here to do." And I said, "Okay, what is that?" And they said, "It's time for you to start a group to help people like you, to help the experiencers." They told me what to name it. They said, "You call it Starborn Support." They said, "Someday the world will know who you are. You will help many, and everyone involved will become ambassadors for the planet." So what am I going to say? "No, sorry, you got something better to do?" No, ain't going to happen. I didn't know what to do. I could barely operate the computer. I started I think it was a MySpace page and phone number, and said, "Okay, there you go, I did it." And then from there, it just kicked off, and I've been working with thousands of experiencers. They came to me again in 2012 and told me it was time to start gathering them. So that's when the conference was born, and they did tell me what to name that too. Seems that whatever's going on is not just extraterrestrial, in my opinion. This is biblical, this is interdimensional, this is a spiritual inner journey for many. I feel like we're the ground crew, and we're here to start helping the earth heal, and the vibrations and frequencies we have to raise, as well as end the corruption and evil that is controlling this planet right now. So I do as much as I can, but because I'm doing what I'm told and doing it well, I've also become a target.
Sure.
I've had many attempts on my life.
Really?
Recent one, a couple weeks ago, two of them. I've been shut down on the computer, the attempts on my life.
Wait, what happened?
Well, let's see, the last one, was. My boyfriend, Travis Walton, a good friend of mine and roommate, Eric Mitchell, who you'll hear about his case really soon, and myself were in bed. And we woke up when it was a Tuesday morning, and I was freezing. And I have a brand new furnace. Now this furnace is perfect. I mean, I just put it in the year before. It operated for one season. Now I know how much fuel I had and how long it should last. I called the gas company to see about my K1, and they said, Audrey, it shouldn't be empty. You go out and check it. So I went outside and checked it, and it was bone dry. It never goes bone dry. I had at least 2-3 months to go. Now, when I first called them, I asked them to come and make a delivery, and they said, well, it's not on our scheduled route. We'll have to charge you $100 to do it off route. Why don't you go to Walmart and buy a jug of K1 and wait till Friday? I did that. I had Eric get it. He poured it in, but something inside me said, you need to call them back. So I called them back, and I said, I want you to come out here. I'll pay the $100. Just do the delivery, please. Well, I brought Travis to the airport when the guy showed up to deliver oil. Eric, my roommate, then says that there was a knock on the door. So he let the guy in. The guy said he was from the oil company, and he was here to look at the furnace. So Eric showed him where the furnace was. And I told Eric, really pay attention to what he's doing in case this happens again. We need to do something. Ask, you know, is there a reset? Ask some questions. Yeah. So he stood over the guy's shoulder, and the guy opens up the unit, and he stopped for a minute. And he looked up, and he said, I don't know who was in here last, but whoever it was is intentionally trying to kill you. Wow. And he said, I don't know how you lived through last night, but you would have died tonight. Now, what they did, whoever they are, is come into my house, clamped all the vents that would release the carbon monoxide. Then they put in a piece of fabric that reacts to the K1, and then when it gets wet, it evaporates and turns to a poison, and then it will set fire.
Oh, wow.
So once, I mean, this furnace is right near my bedroom. I've got two floor vents that blast it right into my room. There's floor vents all over the house. It's central. Everything in there would have died, and then my house would have caught fire and nobody would have known. Well, when I heard this, of course I'm panicking, saying, what? And he explained, you know, he had to rebuild the whole system. He was in here fixing it, removing stuff, and he did all kinds of stuff. So I said, well, did you get his name or anything? He said, oh no, but you know, call Dead River. It was the guy that was at your house. I said, all right, well, I'm gonna think about this. I don't know what to do. The next day I get a call from my oil company. And they said, it's time to schedule a routine appointment to fix your furnace. And I said, well, what about the guy that was there yesterday? He practically rebuilt the whole thing. And they said, Audrey, we didn't send anybody in there yesterday. And I said, what are you talking about? I just need to talk to him because he said some, you know, what was wrong and I wasn't home. And he said, Audrey, there's nobody from our service department that went there. They only came and dropped off oil. And I said, well, I called you guys, and she said, Audrey, I am the service department. It wasn't us.
Wow.
So now I don't even know what to do. A second time this past month, went to Travis Walton's house, my boyfriend. We went for a conference in Sedona. I had to rent a car because his truck wasn't running well. So I followed him very slowly with my hazards going through the really dark, windy roads of Arizona. Well, next thing you know, I have this giant SUV behind me with two sets of headlights and then some fog lamps that were set on blind. And he came right up behind me. He's on my butt. Then he drive right up next to me, kind of sliding me over, and he's going behind me and next to me, really intimidating. I was freaking out. So I called Travis and I said, look, I said, we need to do something about this guy. I said, well, let's pull over. So we pulled over and he pulled over and he stopped and he sat there with us. So then we went a little further and he said, look, why don't you pull off the road, pull right in front of me, because we did have weapons, but they were in the trunk. So I pulled right in front of him. We pull off, it was planned, I pull in front of him, pop the trunk, get out, grab the guns. The guy pulls off with us and is sitting there blazing us with his lights. What we didn't realize was there was only one way in and one way out, so we had to turn around and go back that way. Well, at this point, the guy saw us pull what we pulled out of the trunk. So he backed up and he went ahead of us. So Travis says, get up behind him and get his license plate. So, I mean, I was going like 100 trying to get this guy's plate, but he ran. And then 20 minutes later, we're cruising down and here come the cops. So the cops pulled us over and we explained to him what happened. And he said, yeah, that was the guy who called us. And they did radio ahead and told all the other cops that we were coming through and to, you know, they'd already dealt with it and filled him in. I ended up getting a tow truck, putting Travis's truck on the truck and drove back behind the tow truck, which was this big monster truck, you know. So that was the last one, but there's been many. My emails, my phones, my cable, everything's been tampered with. They have stopped any emails coming into my support group. They stole my domain name and my website. I called the company and said, what's going on? I've owned this for 10 years. I've prepaid. What's up? And they said, well, this is really strange. Somebody bought it and we can't find who it is. It's like they just disappeared. So that was the beginning of the end of Experiencer Speak, because then they started holding all the emails and making, and they were telling people that it was sold out. Whoever was answering my phone, when it's rerouted, it doesn't go to my Starboard hotline anymore. So whoever was doing that, that was the beginning. So my phones are all monitored. I'm constantly surveilled. Kathy Martin published a picture that I had taken of one of the black helicopters that just decided, wanted to come in and intimidate me. I live in a little tiny town in Maine in a trailer park. And this thing, I was washing dishes, and this thing came down eye level and stared me down in the helicopter. So I went outside and took a picture, which Kathy Martin published in her book. Now the first day Eric moves into my house, I tell everybody, if you're gonna be here, I'm a target, be careful. I don't want anybody getting hurt because of me. So he had taken a shower, he was in the shower, and I started hearing a helicopter, and I have a skylight in my shower. Well, this helicopter was positioned over the skylight, videotaping Eric in the shower. Eric's another experiencer, Eric Mitchell. He's got the biggest case I've ever heard of, more evidence than anyone. So they don't want him to do that either.
How long before the Q&A?
Are you ready?
I'm just getting
my 8 minutes, up. About 6
okay.
minutes.
Okay, well, can you tell people where to find your stuff online?
Oh. Sure. My group's name is Starborn Support. You can Google Audrey Hewins or Audrey Starborn. The phone number is 207-461-0628, and that's a 24-hour hotline. If you don't hear back from me, please try to reach me another way, audreystarborn@yahoo.com. or Audrey Hewins on Facebook to message me. We also have a radio show on Sunday nights or Saturday nights on KGRA called Starborn Connections that you can listen to. I'm not personally a host, but some of my team is. So, you know, we help experiencers through a lot, and that's my assignment. So I'm happy to be doing my job.
All right, awesome, thank you.
No problem.
All right, and that concludes the segments for this week's show. Later in the week, we have a roundtable on a subject that has been requested numerous times by people. We discuss Tom DeLonge's appearance on Joe Rogan's podcast. So you might want to check out Joe Rogan's podcast with Tom DeLonge, just so you know what we're talking about. You can always check it out afterwards. But we kind of take apart what we think is going on and how it reflects things that have already happened in the past. We have Greg Bishop with us. It's actually probably the biggest roundtable we've done. I had Greg Bishop, Joshua Cutchin, Adam Sane, and Red Pill Junkie, and, of course, myself. So bigger than a normal roundtable for us. That'll be up on the website this week. If you listen to us on WVBR or Dark Matter Radio, keep in mind there are usually 2 to 3 shows a week, and the rest of them you can get off the website or iTunes or Stitcher or whatever your preference may be. And to take you out tonight, I think we're going to go with some Albat Twitch, which we were talking about in the first segment. This is one of the less abrasive songs on the album. If corporations are people, why won't they die? This is Timothy Renner, one of Timothy Renner's bands, and this is a song called Pin. And thank you all for listening. See you next time. Have been listening to Where Did the Road Go? This show is made possible in part from our Patreons, and we thank you and everyone listening for helping us continue this exploration of the strange. You can always find everything Where Did the Road Go related at www.wheredidtheroadgo.com, and thank you so much for your support.